This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 6th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, after the first failed meeting, Hillary Clinton and Sergey Lavrov are meeting today in Dublin, this time under the eye of UN Peace Envoy Lakhdar Brahimi. We ask if any hope can be drawn from their second encounter.
Speculation is that the Russians are beginning to sense that maybe the Assad regime might fall at some stage and are softening their opposition, putting pressure on them, realizing that they need to shift away and try and put some support behind the regime that will come in its place.
We'll be looking back at the life and work of celebrated Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer, who passed away yesterday at the age of 104.
Niemeyer was very good in that. He was very, very consistent, all the time defending the social justice, but without, as I said, celebrating the happiness.
Plus, our roving contributing editor Alicia Kirby finds out how intellectual content could be the new focus of today's luxury hoteliers.
I think that the demanding customer will ask for more than just sleep and food. He will ask for intellectual inspiration for his children as well as for himself, and for his wife as well as for himself, or the other way around. So for heterogeneous families and individuals.
All that, plus we'll have some music and we'll have plenty more too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So heaps to pack in over the next hour, but first let's catch up on the headlines with David Spencer.
Barricades have been built by the Egyptian army around Cairo's presidential palace. Tanks and armoured vehicles moved in after violent overnight clashes between supporters and opponents of President Morsi. Five people died and hundreds more were injured. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton hopes the situation can be resolved without the loss of any more life.
We call on all the stakeholders in Egypt to settle their differences through discussion and debate, not through violence. And we call on Egypt's leaders to ensure that the outcome protects the democratic promise of the revolution for all Egyptians.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's expressed concern over the possible use of Syrian chemical weapons. That's despite Syrian claims that the West is whipping up fears about chemical weapons as a pretext for intervention. A search is continuing in the North Sea for six sailors who are missing after a collision between a cargo ship and a container vessel. The Corvus J and the Baltic Ace collided on Wednesday evening off the Belgian and Dutch coast. All the crew on the Corvus J remain on board. Five bodies have been recovered after the Baltic Ace sank, and Coast Guard Peter Westenberg says there's little chance of finding anyone alive.
Some Coast Guard vessels are on scene right now investigating the ship that's underwater. That has sunk, and also telling the other vessels in the vicinity that there is a wreckage in the water, because the water is not very deep, so we do not want another collision right now.
The Afghan intelligence chief Asadullah Khalid has been wounded in a suspected suicide bombing in Kabul. It's understood from security sources that the blast happened in one of the guest houses used by Mr. Khalid. Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti's faced a revolt by Silvio Berlusconi's PDL party in a move that threatens fresh political turmoil. Ahead of an election next year, his party walked out of a Senate confidence vote. The symbolic gesture didn't directly threaten the government's survival, but underlines uncertainty in Italian politics. Political analyst Professor James Walston from the American University in Rome says Mr. Berlusconi was upset at comments from a rival politician.
It was undiplomatic of the minister to point out that Berlusconi is probably not a help to Italy, but that shouldn't be enough for Berlusconi to say we're going to bring the government down.
Apple says it's begun assembling Mac computers in the United States in a bid to boost American production. US Chief Executive Tim Cook says they want to do more and more in the United States, with most of their products currently assembled in China. He says Apple will be investing more than $100 million in making more product in the US. That's the latest on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. The last meeting between the US, Russia and the UN peace envoy to Syria, designed to foster the idea of a transitional government, ended in Russia pulling out after America apparently insisted on pressuring Assad to leave, with hints of economic sanctions and use of force in the air. Former peace envoy Kofi Annan eventually resigned from the post after his peace plan failed, while Hillary Clinton and her Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov remain in the equation. The UN's Lakhdar Brahimi has now been tasked with fostering new steps towards some kind of a plan, and the three are meeting today in Dublin. We'll assess the latest news from Syria in just a moment, but first let's unpick what potential hope could be drawn from the meeting in Dublin today. Jeff Dyer, foreign policy correspondent for the Financial Times, spoke to me shortly before we came on air, and I started by asking what we could expect to come out of these talks.
It's a surprise meeting. It wasn't something that was scheduled, so that suggests that there is something in the works. Speculation is that the Russians are beginning to sense that maybe the Assad regime might fall at some stage and are softening their opposition to putting pressure on them, realizing that they need to shift away and try and put some support behind the regime that will come in its place. So that's the speculation, is that the Russians are beginning to move their position. However, there have been a number of cases like this in the last few months where there has been indications that the Russians were shifting and then they double-backed and then reinforced their support of Assad. So at this stage, we don't know exactly what is going on, but that is what it seems to be.
Indeed, and I mean, it has a precedent when Clinton met Lavrov in June and it looked like things were reaching an agreement that a transitional government could be formed, but then things broke down and the Russians retreated a little bit. What's changed in the last 6 months that means that this could have a different outcome this time?
If the Russians have indeed moved, it's probably because they sense that things on the ground might be shifting quite quickly. We can't tell for sure, it's a very complicated situation, but the indications are that the rebel groups in Syria are gaining ground, that they are gradually exerting more control over different bits of the country, and they are putting more and more pressure on the government forces. And perhaps that is what is making the Russians think twice about their strong backing of Assad and thinking that they need to shift position and change gears.
Call me a cynic, but do you think it is also could be just that Russia wants to keep its foot in with all the talks and so keeps on joining the discussions and making it seem like they are amenable to change and softening, but then withdrawing at the last minute because they have no intention of not supporting Assad?
That is also entirely possible as well. I mean, they have done that sort of move in the past. You know, they do want to be a central player in this. But if it is the case that the regime is weakening, which some people seem to think, then it would make sense for the Russians to slightly shift their position and start looking elsewhere. As you said, you cannot say for sure. We don't know for sure what's really happening in Syria, what the kind of different balance of forces is between the rebel groups and the army. So we can't say for sure. But there are some indications that that might be what's happening.
And what do you think the mood will be like in that room in Dublin? It's obviously Hillary Clinton and Lavrov and also Lakhdar Brahimi. Will it be incredibly tense and heated, do you think, or is it very sort of polite faces?
Well, I mean, they have exchanged some pretty sharp words in the past, that's for sure. But they're, you know, they're very professional politicians and they do actually end up meeting quite often. And I don't think this would be a particularly tense meeting, especially if, you know, the Russians are feeling the ground for taking a different position. They're not coming into this meeting on the back of some big standoff at the UN or some sort of big ongoing argument. So this will be a slightly more good-natured meeting than probably some of the ones they've had in the past.
And what is the role of Lakhdar Brahimi in this going forward, do you think?
Well, that's a bit unclear. I mean, he's been a lot more low-profile than Kofi Annan was doing this job. He's more just tried to stay more quiet and be in the background and liaising between different groups. But the fact that he is involved in this meeting suggests that he is at least having some role in trying to articulate different positions and pull different people together. And that is ultimately what the role of the UN envoy would be, to try and get together different people, get them talking, and hope that something can come from that.
Jeff Dyer from the Financial Times there. And we're joined now by Middle Eastern expert and professor of American Studies at Birmingham University, Scott Lucas. Scott, thank you for joining us. We've heard today that the German cabinet has approved stationing anti-missile batteries on Turkey's border following a chemical weapons scare in Syria. How serious a move is this?
Well, it's a serious move, but it's not just because of the chemical weapons scare. That story... in part, is actually cover for a much bigger development, which is that, in effect, the Patriot missiles could well be supporting because a protected zone inside northern Syria. Jeff Dyer referred to insurgents possibly making gains. No, it's not possibly. They have made gains, serious gains. And what's happened is that those Patriot missiles, backed by Turkey, backed by the Europeans, and significantly backed by the U.S., that's the force that's going to deter Assad's military from trying to strike back.
And could we see the imposition of a no-fly zone imminently, do you think?
I don't think we're going to see a no-fly zone declared openly in public, but what we're getting is a no-fly zone which is going to be possible in practice. We have to wait and see, and that is, will Assad try to challenge the insurgents with significant air power? Will he try to bring in tanks on the ground? I doubt he can hit back with ground power. Whether he sends in fighters or helicopters, that's going to be the test case. I think, in part, the meeting that you were examining earlier, the meeting which is taking place between the U.S. and Russia, is that the Russians are being told that this is the situation, that the protected zone is now in place, and that they now need to begin preparing for a post-Assad moment.
And so the news that we've heard of the Russians softening their approach, do you think is that something that definitely has legs then?
I think there's actually a missing piece to the puzzle here, and that is that a few days ago, the Russian President Vladimir Putin met the Turkish Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, in Turkey. Now, we do not know what they discussed in private. There really hasn't been a leak of that. But I suspect that the Turks were passing on messages to Putin that this is now a changed situation. And what you're seeing today is a follow-up by Ms. Clinton to say that the Americans stand behind the Turks. Will the Russians accept it? You know, that's something we'll have to wait and see over the next few days. But I would agree in general that I think the Russians realize they can no longer count on Assad staying in power for the long term.
The Syrian government, understandably, has come out with some fighting talk saying that the West is using chemical weapons, rumours really, as a pretext for intervention. And it sounds as if they're right. I mean, is there any evidence at all for chemical weapons being held by the Syrians?
Well, certainly the Syrians have chemical weapons, or they have stocks. I mean, the foreign ministry spokesman, Mr. Makdizi, who just defected, said that several months ago. Whether the Syrians actually have chemical weapons that are on the verge of being operational and whether they would use them if they're operational, that's a much bigger question. I do think that there is a priority for the United States, the Europeans, and the Turks to secure chemical weapon stocks. I don't believe that the recent moves we're seeing is because they believe those chemical weapons are on the verge of being used.
Well, Scott Lucas, I'm sure we'll be returning to you soon in the next few days. But thank you very much indeed for coming on. We'll be back after this short break to hear how intellectual content could be the next big draw in the luxury hotel trade.
This Christmas, Monocle 24 is packing its earmuffs, mittens, sticks and skis as we head up the Alps to sunny St. Moritz for a winter retreat. We'll be bringing you a Christmas stocking full of shows, including The Briefing, Midori House, and The Review. So join our editors and their guests for a festive spree of friends and family, debate and discussion, with plenty of mulled wine, from Boxing Day all the way to New Year's Day 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick and span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. It's 1815 in London. It's 1915 in Cannes, and that's where the elite of the world's luxury travel industry are currently gathered. They're rubbing shoulders and networking away at the invite-only international luxury travel market. With them is our contributing editor, Alicia Kirby, who's not only sniffing out where the next best place is to take a holiday, but who's going and why. She's got her finger on the pulse of what the latest trends are in the market and what's driving them. And she met up with Dietmar Müller-Elmo, owner of Schloss Elmo Hotel, to find out what today's hoteliers have on their eye and on their minds and the intellectual content that they can offer.
I built a hotel for myself and I'm interested in intellectual content and the music. So I try to build a venue, an environment where the space is provided to have political debate, to have literary events and to have classical music and jazz concerts. That's what I understand at content. There may be different contents. You have the spa content, the massages, the treatments, etc. You have the food content, which is, of course, but I wanted the food for thought content playing a major role. I think that the demanding customer will ask for more than just sleep and food. He will ask for intellectual inspiration for his children as well as for himself, and for his wife as well as for himself, or the other way around, and maybe also for the grandfather or grandmother, so for heterogeneous families and individuals. Even as an individual myself, I have different interests during the day, depending on the weather. If the weather is bad, what am I going to do in a ski resort if the weather is bad and I can't ski? You're stuck. You get a nervous breakdown. So you would like to have a great bookstore. You would like to have a library, which is not keeping trash, but valuable books up to date, the latest, and also some of the classics maybe as well.
Your hotel has one of the largest hotel bookshops in the world and three libraries, as I understand it. Tell us a bit more, because you have some quite illustrious residents who come and write at your hotel as well.
Well, the ones you probably know, like Ian McEwan, he spends sometimes weeks there, and Orhan Pamuk, and also politicians like Carl Bildt, which is featured in your, or Davutoglu, and so on. And all of these people are, they use vacation time to read. It's the number one activity in vacation. And the high-end market, I would assume. That's what I do, because you need the calm environment to be able to read and concentrate, besides going to the spa and hiking and sports and skiing and everything else. Now, most ski resorts don't have that, or they have kind of a library, but they just don't have really sophisticated books there. You need not to just have a library. It's not enough to have just a library. We have got actually two libraries, one working library and one just for reading. Some people need to do work and write papers, like Ian McEwan or whatever, but you also need a bookstore, because not everybody wants to carry all the books. Even if they have the Kindle, some people just still like to have books, paper in their hands.
And do you think this is a kind of path that a lot of the luxury brands are going to follow, starting with the libraries?
Yes, I think that they will have to start with the bookstore before the libraries. And the bookstore they have to address to the clientele. So our bookstore is fairly big and it's divided into two sections, for adults and for children. Because parents, particularly when they go to these high luxury hotels, they are very, very interested in education of the children. They don't want the children to waste their time on trash, so they're looking for literature all the time. In fact, kids are our biggest customers, and it's absolutely independent of the economic situation. They always want to buy good books for children, and you have to dress it as a matter of respect, also a matter of interest for your own family. I think that the key to this is to find a librarian or a bookstore manager who is up to date, who knows what's in the books, not just a shopping agent or something like that. That doesn't work. And there has to be passion from the owners to sort of to make the investment in space, to provide a spacious environment, an inspiring environment for the bookstore. And in addition to the bookstore, you also need the library. You need a library in the spa, because what do people do in the spa? They read. But it's a different kind of literature they read in the spa than they read when they are in the main hotel. Because in the spa, you're a little tired, you've been exhausted, you rather have maybe, you would like to see art, books of art and things like that. And one of the other libraries, you've got more philosophy, religion, politics, fiction, etc. And then another library, you may have a working environment with big tables and computer access, etc. So you can actually work on your thesis or on your book.
And are there any other ways that hotels are trying to implement more intellectual content?
There are many different ways that people can do it. I think that some, if they don't have the venue for a concert hall or for literary halls like we have it, they may just maybe do invite authors and residents to write and have meetings with their guests. I know one hotel that does it. They copied it from us, but they saw they could never do it exactly like us, so they did it on a smaller scale. But I think it's just the whole point that, you know, reading being number one activity in vacation, the hotels have to provide possibilities to read. Now, some hotels will give the guests a Kindle or an iPad. Most guests have that already anyway. It says we don't need all of that stuff. But it's a different atmosphere, different interior design. Everything is different when you also provide books which you can touch, and not everything is just computerized.
That was Dietmar Müller-Elmo, owner of the Schloss Elmo Hotel, speaking to our contributing editor Alicia Kirby at the International Luxury Travel Market in Cannes there. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, to most people, Barbie is the blonde doll with the impossibly thin figure, a 17-year-old girl who lives in Malibu, California, drives a convertible and has a boyfriend named Ken. But now Barbie is making the leap into fashion with a shop in the heart of Tokyo's youth fashion district, Harajuku. It's been attracting a different kind of customer from the preteen girls you might normally expect, though. Barbie's main audience in Tokyo is Japanese women in their 20s and 30s. They've been flocking to get heart-shaped chocolates and Barbie lip gloss and T-shirts, though the shop has dolls too. Monocle's Kenji Hall dropped by for Wednesday's grand opening party, where he spoke with Mattel Japan's senior designer, Mio Watanabe.
My name is Mio Watanabe. I work for Mattel Japan, and I'm a senior designer there. And we are standing right in front of the new Barbie store, which opened in Harajuku.
Why Harajuku? This is the first Barbie shop in Tokyo, in Japan.
Yes, that is correct. And the reason why our licensed company, Icon, open this shop. There's a reason. Harajuku area is the most fashionable city and town, and the young people would come and visit.
In Japan, we already have Rika-chan,
yes,
which is similar to Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
There are some subtle differences, and if you could talk about those differences.
Barbie is a doll, but it's not doll, only a doll or character. It's also, you know, fashion icon. Barbie has been a fashion icon for a long period of time, so she featured in like magazines, fashion magazines, a lot in the past. But I heard Rika-chan supposed to be 11 year old, and the Barbie supposed to be 17 year old, so she's a lot older and matured, I think. Barbie fans in Japan are more older compared to other region. And for other region, Barbie target is a lot younger because this, you know, our audience is very unique. So we try to produce more adult-tasted products.
And that would be, for instance?
Apparel, for instance, it's, you know, targeted for 20s women, and also stationery. Those stationeries are not like, you know, notes for little kids, notes for matured women. So I see many, you know, our acquaintances who has those notes, but they are 20s and 30s women.
Why is it that Japanese women, you know, tend to be a little bit older than the normal target audience elsewhere?
We do have a history with Barbie, and those first girls who played with Barbie doll grown up and they're like 40s, 30s and 40s women. So they have children. So mothers like, and then girls like, you know, they have a similar taste. So I think we have two big targeted age in Japan.
So it actually opened a month ago, a soft opening. How have sales been? What are the hot selling items in the barbershop?
Many products are selling quite well, but I should point out stationery is really nice to have because it's very easy to purchase, and it's using robot-based illustrations, which is very original and elegant looking. And others would be bags, many sizes of tote bags and travel bags. They are nice to have one.
So some of the items that you sell here, you don't sell anywhere else in the world?
Original items, yes. You can purchase only at this store.
You're in charge of Barbie's design in this market, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the things that you can do for Barbie items and the things that you can't do.
Okay, to make things as a Barbie branding, there's a 5 elements you have to follow. You cannot just place Barbie logo on top of black t-shirt and call it, this is a Barbie brand. So the first characteristic is power pink, which is PMS 219, that we call it hot pink. And the second would be luxe, you know, luxurious looking, and sparkles. And also we do have icons, Barbie icons, and the second branding image is, we call it silhouette, which is Barbie's profile image with a ponytail, and we call it as a second branding. And the last one would be the playfulness. So something has to have a playful feeling to it.
That was Mattel Japan's senior designer Mia Watanabe speaking to Monocle's Kenji Hall there at the opening of the new Barbie store in Tokyo. Now, in a moment, we'll have the news headlines at the bottom of the hour. But first, here's David Bowie with Fashion. That was David Bowie there with Fashion. In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be welcoming Professor Joanna Burke into the studio to explore her new symposium on pain at the Wellcome Collection in London. And we'll be celebrating the life and work of Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer too. But before all that, here's David Spencer with news headlines.
Thank you. Barricades have been built by the Egyptian army around Cairo's presidential palace. Tanks and armoured vehicles moved in after violent overnight clashes between supporters and opponents of President Morsi. 5 people died and hundreds more were injured in the clashes. A search is continuing in the North Sea for 6 sailors who are missing after a collision between a cargo ship and a container vessel. The Corvus J and the Baltic Ace collided on Wednesday evening off the Belgian and Dutch coast. All the crew on the Corvus J remain on board. 5 bodies have been recovered after the Baltic Ace sank. The Afghan intelligence chief, Asadullah Khalid, has been wounded in a suspected suicide bombing in Kabul. It's understood from security sources that the blast happened in one of the guest houses used by Mr. Khalid. Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti's faced a revolt by Silvio Berlusconi's PDL party in a move that threatens fresh political turmoil. Ahead of an election early next year, his party walked out of a Senate confidence vote. The symbolic gesture didn't directly threaten the government's survival, but underlines uncertainty in Italian politics. Apple says it's begun assembling Mac computers in the United States for the first time in a bid to boost American production. US Chief Executive Tim Cook says they want to do more and more in the United States, with most of their products currently assembled in China. That's the latest on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from London, where the time is 18:32. Pain and its meanings. That's a two-day event that unpicks the cultural explorations around the theme of physical pain opens tomorrow at London's Wellcome Collection, where science and art combine for endlessly fascinating, brilliantly curated exhibitions and lecture series. To talk to us about the unpleasant but curiously difficult to describe sensation of pain and to tell us what to expect from the event, we're joined in the studio by Joanna Burke, facilitator of the symposium and professor of history at Birkbeck University. Welcome to Midori House, Joanna.
It's really pleased. Good to be here.
Well, pain, as I said there, is something that we all obviously experience, hopefully not too often, but we definitely all know the sensation. And yet people do find it very difficult to put it into words. Why is that?
I think it is difficult to put into words because it's precisely because it's a really, really deeply personal and intimate sensation. I think we do. It's easy, though, to exaggerate the difficulty of talking about pain because, of course, it's difficult to talk about any sensation. I mean, you just try and talk about love or sexual jouissance or anything like this. I mean, these are always difficult. What I think is really fascinating, though, about pain is that the lengths that people go in order to communicate, particularly to their loved ones.
Absolutely. And it's no surprise that pain, along with love and a lot of other sensations that you've just mentioned that are difficult to put into words, is the subject of so much poetry and artistic expression because it's sort of the easiest way to try and communicate it. But where did the idea for this symposium come from?
Well, basically, it comes out of a two-year, which has now been extended for three-year, Wellcome Trust Institute, if you like, on the Birkbeck Pain Project. There are three of us, myself, Joanna Burke, Louise Hyde and Carmen Mangin. And we're three historians who really want to work out, well, is pain the same always? How have people in the past, from the 18th century to the present, how have they understood, how have they interpreted this, if you like, a universal experience, but something that's changed dramatically over time? So this symposium really comes out of an historical project. But what we're trying to do is actually engage very seriously with other disciplines. So we have clinicians, we have artists, we have musicians, we have sociologists, we have activists who are all coming basically to share their knowledge, their research and their enthusiasm actually for this topic to see if we can actually create something different and exciting.
And are you hoping to sort of synthesize all these different opinions and different approaches and expressions of pain into something that is like a sort of categorical expression of what pain is? Or is it really just to sort of catalogue a lot of different people and their sort of reactions to pain?
Well, I think it really is to get that conversation started and to get people really just talking to each other and exchanging information. Now, of course, you know, the Birkbeck Pain Project is publishing a lot. I have a book coming out on the history of pain at the end of the year. So there will be all these different elements to it, which of course is going to involve the science, the art, the sociology. But I think in terms of the symposium, it's actually just to get people talking to each other, a conversation going.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my research before we came on air, I typed pain into Google just to see what came up. And
don't
was
we
surprised.
All do that?
Well, I know, exactly. I was surprised to learn that pain has its own Wikipedia page, which opens with the line that pain is an unpleasant feeling often caused by intense or damaging stimuli, such as stubbing a toe, burning a finger, putting alcohol on a cut, and bumping the funny bone.
Yes, but I mean, pain is actually a lot more than that because
exactly.
It's really interesting that so many pains are actually not caused by noxious stimuli, you know, and that's the interesting thing about it.
No, totally, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about who is going to be at the symposium and who's going to be talking.
Well, we have a group of people coming to talk. On the Friday night, we have a musician, we have a filmmaker, and we have a poet who are going to basically present their work in the field. and then we'll have a discussion about what can the arts, if you like, contribute to our understanding of pain. And then Saturday, we have people from different disciplines coming to speak, clinicians, sociologists, literary critics, historians, of course, like myself, and activists, who are all going to be talking. I think, though, what we want to do on that Saturday is actually to ask questions about, well, what is the political meaning of pain? How have people in the past and today understood pain? How can we help people in pain? How can we actually talk to people in pain? And what are some of the difficulties that people, patients in particular, are experiencing when they try to communicate, particularly to clinicians, to doctors?
Mm. Pain is obviously quite close to pleasure as well. In terms of a sensation that we all experience, and some people enjoy pain. Have you, throughout your research, been sort of surprised by some of the findings that you've found that maybe you could share with us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an historian, so of course I get really, really passionate about the very different ways that people in the past understood pain. And I think one of the really striking things about past people's experience of pain is actually how pain is welcomed. Pain is embraced. Pain is actually a good thing. You know, you suffer in this world, so you don't have to suffer in the next world. And in periods before we have effective anesthetics or analgesics, you know, there's a sense that pain is much more accepted every day. It's something you submit to. Whereas, of course, today we don't submit to pain; we fight it. Mm-hmm. You know, with every sort of being in our body. You know, pain is something isn't evil that must be got rid of as quickly as possible. Pop that pill, go to the doctor, you know, very, very quickly. And if you're like me, extremely quickly. But, you know, this is very different. You know, people in the past, actually, even after we had effective anesthetics, people would actually refuse anesthetics or refuse chloroform because of this belief that pain actually helped create the good self.
And also that pain makes you stronger.
Pain makes you stronger.
Yeah. Can sort of put up with pain, or, you know, be it emotional pain or physical pain of whatever description, you learn from it in some way.
Absolutely. It makes you stronger. And by experiencing pain, you can sympathise with others. So pain actually creates communities. It doesn't necessarily, of course, it sometimes divides communities, but it actually creates loving, sympathetic interrelationships.
Fascinating. Well,
it's great, I think.
It's open for everybody to come along as well, or is it?
Absolutely. I mean, you can sign up by going on the internet.
Brilliant. Well, Joanna Burke, thank you very much indeed for coming in and telling us a little bit about the Pain Symposium happening at the Wellcome Collection this weekend. In a moment, we'll be celebrating the life and work of Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer, who sadly passed away in his native Rio de Janeiro yesterday. But first, this is DJ Shadow and Little Dragon with Scale It Back. That was Scale It Back by DJ Shadow and Little Dragon there. You're listening to Midori House. The time in London is 18:43. We'll be back in a short moment to pay tribute to the legendary Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer, who passed away yesterday at the age of 104.
Monocle's third annual Soft Power Survey is an attempt to push the debate on where soft power comes from and how to use it. And with current shifts in the global power balance, never has it been more relevant.
The unofficial yet undisputed leader of Europe relies on the strength of its business brands. While Angela Merkel has been hesitant to do what is necessary to drag the continent out of its economic malaise, Germany has just about enough in its soft power arsenal, from the Goethe Institute to the popularity of its football league, to keep it near the top.
From culture to sport, cuisine to diplomacy, find out which countries are best at wielding their weapons of soft power by watching our countdown in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time in London is 18:44. Now, the Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer died of respiratory failure yesterday in his home city of Rio de Janeiro at the age of 104. To describe him as an architect doesn't really do him justice. To the architecture world, he was a visionary. To the Brazilians, he was a father figure, responsible for turning their modern identity into concrete and building a new capital city to boot. His buildings are extraordinary, like sculptures, technically and visually impossible. On visiting Brasilia, Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, said it was like landing on a different planet. Sir Norman Foster paid a glowing tribute to him today, saying, "He told me that architecture is important, but that life is more important." Well, in a moment, we'll be joined in the studio by Professor of Architectural History at the Bartlett, Adrian Forty, to discuss the power and influence of Niemeyer's built legacy. But first, I caught up with current Brazilian architect Milton Braga from MMBB shortly before we came on air. It's obviously a very sad day for everybody in Brazil and the architecture industry the world over as well. What is the mood like in Brazil today?
It's a very sad day, as you said, and I think everybody in Brazil was prepared for that day. We have been preparing ourselves for that day long ago, because it was surprising how long was his career and his life. But when the day came, finally, nobody, in a way, was prepared. Everybody is really, really sad. And several manifestations already came up, not only among architects, but also among the population. He was very known in Brazil, probably the most known, let's say, artist or intellectual. So this is really a sad day, and we were not prepared at the end of the day.
Of course, no one really ever is, however old someone is or however ill they've been. But you say there that Niemeyer was so much more than an architect, which is true, and he was held in the hearts of Brazilians from across the board, because he really was the person who converted into, well, concrete, but certainly into architecture, modern Brazil. Do you think that's fair?
Yes, he was certainly the one architect that gave a visual expression to the transformation of Brazil in the mid-90s, during the 20th century, transforming when Brazil was trying to become not anymore a colonial country, but a new and a republican country. And he was perhaps the most important person in terms of assigning a visual expression to that.
And also, he was sort of the father of Brazilian architecture and so many younger practices who have emerged since, including your own, have sort of taken his lead in terms of expression as well. So his legacy isn't just his own buildings, but also the confidence that it's given many other Brazilian architects to set up a practice themselves as well.
Yes, definitely. I was thinking of, let's say, ideas that I wanted to highlight. And the first one was more or less the one that answers your question, but in a broader sense, because I think Niemeyer was a very influential personality, not only as an architect, to architects, of course, but also as a, let's say, a citizen, because he always knew how to combine the intellectual and the professional thinking and action with the enjoying of the life. He all the time made us to believe that it's possible to be an important intellectual or an important person, professional, etc., without suffering, without giving away the quality of life, the opportunity to be with your friends, to enjoy the music. That was a very Brazilian way of being, which I think is the good side of the Brazilian culture. And I think he was really, really inspiring, not only for the thinking and the professional activity, but also for the living, which I think is very, very important.
And quite apart from the sort of built legacy, the architecture projects, which will remain standing for years and decades and centuries, one hopes, what other legacy do you think he will be remembered for in Brazil?
Well, he was the one that brought joy and likeness to the modern architecture. One of the guys, maybe the, as I said, a Brazilian contribution, perhaps the biggest one for the history of architecture in the whole world. Because until then, until Igreja da Pampulha, the small church in Pampulha, Belo Horizonte, one of the main cities in Brazil, until then, basically the architecture was very, very serious. And with that church, he brought some lightness and joy without giving up the agenda of the modern architecture, which was to promote a better city and a more equilibrated society. Niemeyer was very good in that. He was very, very consistent, all the time defending the social justice, but without, as I said, celebrating the happiness. So I think that was his biggest contribution for the history of architecture. And I think it's a lesson that still we have to pay attention to.
Brazilian architect Milton Braga of Sao Paulo practice MMBB talking to me there. And we're joined now in the studio by Professor of Architectural History at University College London's Bartlett School, Adrian Forty. Adrian, thank you very much for coming into the studio. Niemeyer has sadly passed away, and we heard a little bit there about the legacy from Milton Braga, but you have been familiar with Niemeyer's work for years and years and something of an expert. I wonder if you could share an insight that you have into the way that he worked or how his studio managed to produce such incredibly impressive, innovative works over such a long period of time.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it's hard to appreciate just what a legend Niemeyer was in Brazil. That, you know, there are streets named after Niemeyer, there are dry cleaners named after Niemeyer, driving schools, you know, his name's everywhere. You know, he's part of the national identity. And for us, it's just inconceivable that an architect could occupy that kind of position. You know, we're not going to get the Norman Foster Square or the Norman Foster coffee shop or whatever it is. We just don't think like that. We don't treat architects like that. And Niemeyer was just so important in creating an image for what modern Brazil's become. I mean, as far as his own work's concerned, I can't say very much about how he worked. But, I mean, I think the curious... I mean, first of all, what's so extraordinary is that nobody has had a working career as long as his. That, you know, was practising from the 1930s until, you know, very last year. And, I mean, that's extraordinary for somebody to have been working for 80 years. And what's curious about Niemeyer is that, in a way, his work hasn't really changed very much over that time. That most architects who do have a long career, you know, at some point they stop and they reinvent themselves. And Niemeyer, I was thinking about this, didn't really do that. He just ploughed on. And, you know, even in the second millennium was, you know, been producing things that aren't that unrelated to what he was doing, you know, back in the 1940s. So that continuity is sort of extraordinary.
No, absolutely. I mean, something that's been pouring out from personal tributes in the press all over the world is what an incredible character he was as well. And that he wasn't just somebody who built buildings, but he was somebody who really taught people how to live too. And, I mean, do you think that as that extreme sort of expression of joy and pleasure of life as well is something that we will be remembering him for through his buildings?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, pleasure is the word. And, you know, it's ironic that the last bit of this programme was about pain, because Niemeyer's work is entirely about pleasure and sensuality. And what's, you know, people have been taken with is the way in which he translates that into architectural form. That's been remarkable. And, I mean, in a way, you know, there's something comparable between, you know, what he did on architecture and, you know, what happened in bossa nova music, that it's a similar kind of introduction of sensuality, rhythm and so on into architecture, which did something that was really significant. And significant, I think it's important, not just in Brazil, but throughout the world. I mean, you know, the story is that Le Corbusier went to Brazil in the 1930s and was invited by the Brazilians to produce the Ministry of Education building there. And it was a partnership with the Brazilian architects and Le Corbusier. And the Brazilians introduced into this building a lot of quite irrational things. The Ministry of Education building is a really remarkable building because of its undogmatic, curious features that are quite sensuous. And it's really following that Le Corbusier's own work changed and became much less hard-edged, much more sensuous. And he discovered something in himself, which has often been attributed to his experience of working with this Brazilian group, of whom Niemeyer was one. And this has happened many times over, that people have discovered things in Brazilian architecture, which has, as it were, kind of unlocked things in themselves. And I mean, just to, you know, take a contemporary architect, I mean, Zaha Hadid is a tremendous admirer of Niemeyer, and you know, has said how much she learnt from him and how much she's enjoyed his buildings. And, you know, you can see the same kind almost kind of libidinous lack of constraint in what, you know, she does that you know, has some connection. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, Professor of Architectural History, Adrian Forty, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your thoughts. We're going to hear a samba song now composed by Oscar Niemeyer himself while in hospital in 2010 with the help of his nurse. It's called Tranquilo com a Vida, which means relaxed with life.
Prestigiados, que um dia entre nós vão voltar a morar. E assim vou eu,
e assim vou eu.
Tranquilo com a Vida, composed by Oscar Niemeyer, the Brazilian architect who passed away yesterday. And that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Alid John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Next is The Urbanist, which is heading to the Centre for London's second annual conference, where they'll meet planners, architects and policymakers, including Amanda Burden, Richard Florida and Richard Rogers.
London started with about 32 towns in search of a centre, I often jokingly say. Actually, the 32 towns began to grow, and so we don't really have a centre.
In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Emma Nelson and Romas Vezolus will be back for the Monocle Daily. Rob Bound will be back with Midori House tomorrow. Goodbye.